which is part of the IT department, and all our applications, the high degree, developed individually to support the legislative process, the lawmaking process.
Next.
Okay. My name is Christoph Rattinger. I'm also working in the same department as Alexandra and Christoph Konrad. So we're giving legal advice in questions of constitutional law, and we're providing legal assistance to the committees. I, for myself, am dealing with the Committee of Foreign Affairs and the Committee on Human Rights.
Hello, my name is Julia Matas. I'm working in the Department for Committee Support and Investigation Committees. And we are supporting pretty much all of the committees and the colleagues who are working with the committees. We are dealing with legal issues regarding all committees, but also administrative and organizational issues like admission to public sittings or coordination with the responsible department, like security or something. And I have lots of questions regarding video on demand and public committees, how you are dealing with it.
Hello, my name is Franz Kutsch. I'm member of the Department of National Presidential Committee Services, which is part of the National Services. And we provide services for the plenary meetings and for documentation aspects of plenary and also committee meetings.
Hello, my name is Ines Kerle. I'm the head of the unit responsible for media strategy in the Austrian Parliament. And we are also responsible for the upcoming video on demand project in the Austrian Parliament.
Yes. Hi, my name is Stefan Taferner. I work for Ines Kerle's department.
Thank you very much. This was all of you, of us. Sorry. Hi.
It's fine. Yeah, I'm here. I'm here. Okay. Thank you very much. So I think we can start with the presentation. If at any point you need to interrupt me, go ahead. Just give us a split of a second so that your audio does not overlay with ours, okay?
Thanks. Yes.
Okay. So as I mentioned before, this seminar was a lot about the work of the plenary and the committees. My presentation was about the supervisory instruments and the role of the Parliament. I'm not a lawyer myself, so my approach is not so focused on the legal aspects. It's more of an overview of the procedures, but if you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt. I will try to give you a highlight of what the Portuguese political system is, especially because we have a particular system. Also, the role of the Parliament within that system, which is what concerns us the most. Thirdly, I will address, as mentioned before, the presence of the government in the plenary, the presence of the government in the committees, and I will try to highlight some concluding remarks about the overall system that we have and the way the Parliament positions itself in this system. The Portuguese political system, as I mentioned, has a certain degree of complexity. We have a directly elected President of the Republic, as you do in Austria, if I'm not mistaken. Then we have a directly elected Parliament, and the government stems from the Parliament, meaning that the government is composed after the general elections and needs to have the support of the Parliament. The experience that we have since 1976, especially with the Constitution after the Revolution, is that this system is working. The Constitution was revised sometimes in order to develop the system into a more, let's say, perfect way of interaction between these three main actors. It's a system that features mostly separation, balance, and interdependence of powers between the three actors that I described. But however, as one of the main constitutionalists in Portugal refers, and you have a quote there in the PowerPoint, the way the system operates in practice depends on reasons which very often are outside the design of the Constitution, meaning it depends on the results of the elections, it depends on whether we have an absolute majority in the parliament or not, it also depends on the way each actor interprets its own role. For instance, we have presidents of the republic which feel that they should intervene on a daily basis, be on the press every day commenting and exerting influence on the way the government works, and which is the case of the current president, and we have presidents which keep a kind of Queen of England approach, very distant, only intervening when they really deem appropriate. However, the main point that I would like to highlight is that the way it works, and this is also part of the beauty of it, of working in the Parliament, is that the way the Constitution describes the system can be often different from the way reality completes what actors do. The organization of social forces, the party system tradition, especially because in Portugal we've had in the past 40 years a very bipolarized system between the Social Democrats, which in Portugal are EPP, so center-right, and the Socialist Party, which is center-left. They've been on and on, both of them on and off in the government. However, in the current situation, as I will try to describe a little bit further ahead, we have a different shape of the parliament, which also changes the way the parliament is working and trying to affirm its role. As we can see from this slide, I hope you can read it. The slide has, if you see there, we have, this is the result of the last elections we had in 2015. The PSD, which is the Social Democratic Party, was in the government before. We had, as you might have heard, since 2011 until 2014, a financial assistance program with Troika, IMF, the European Commission, and the ECB. This party, PSD, won the elections in 2011. They led the government in a coalition with the Christian Democrats, which is the fourth political party now. And in 2015, in the elections, the PSD came ahead again. However, they lost a significant number of members of parliament, which meant that for the first time in our history, the party who is in the government is not the party who won the elections. This is totally new for us. Even in cases where the party who won was a minority government, it still was able to govern. In this case, a government was formed firstly by the PSD and the Christian Democrats, so the first and the fourth political forces out of the elections, but it was voted down by Parliament, and then the Socialist government, the Socialist Party, sorry, was able to form a government based on three political agreements with three other political forces represented in the Parliament, namely to its left. The left bloc, which came third in the elections, the Communist Party, which is a feature not very common in Europe, and also with the Greens. So this means that the way the Parliament is positioning itself is quite peculiar, because all of a sudden it became the center stage of the political action, because the government, even though they have these three agreements which in the Parliament supports their action, these agreements do not cover all the domains of the governing, but also some fields which the four parties felt were appropriate. So this is as a background for everything I'm going to say. Please bear in mind that the Parliament is now different in the way it is working because of the way the government is composed. The Parliament, as in the majority of cases throughout Europe, it's the main legislative institution. On the other hand, I don't know if it's the same in Austria or not, but in here, of course, I'm biased because I work for the parliament, but the parliament is the most scrutinized and visible institution of all the three that I mentioned before, government, president and parliament. For instance, during the Troika period, all the demonstrations took place outside the parliament, even though many of the measures were not taken by the parliament. Some of them were voted in the parliament, that's true, but many of them were negotiated and decided elsewhere. But this is where people chose to demonstrate, outside the parliament. We were very often locked down here. We couldn't leave by the end of the day to go home because the parliament was in lockdown because of demonstrations. On the other hand, all the public debate and the public visibility of any measures or any governmental decision is also discussed by the parliament. Nowadays we have, and I'm not sure I heard right, but one of your colleagues deals with the video on demand, if I'm not mistaken. One of the colleagues around the table, no?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So in our case, we have since December 2015 a totally new system of broadcasting our committees specially. Prior to that, we could only broadcast one, and very often we have 10, 12 meetings occurring at the same time. And now we have a system that allows us to broadcast online up until 8 committee meetings at the same time, simultaneously. I can then send you the link for the Parliamentary TV channel if you want to. So that means that people at home, people in their offices, I believe that there are people at home and in their offices watching the broadcast of the parliament, they can just choose which committee they want to watch. Not only live, but they can immediately, when the meeting is over, they can go there, download, they can share on their social media, they can set up their favorites, whatever they want to see. Everything is online in real time. So that also changes the way the parliament and members of parliament see their role. Because if you would work here, and my colleagues who work here for a year now, they also might have that feeling by now. It's a totally different thing if a meeting of a committee is being broadcast, the body language of members, the way they speak, the issues they cover, if you compare to a meeting which is behind closed doors and with no media. But nowadays, the majority of meetings are broadcast. So that also brings another layer of attention to what the parliament is doing, and it brings another layer of responsibility to how the parliament exerts its power. As I mentioned before, absolute majority versus minority governments. When we have, and this is the experience of recent years, the tendency is that if you have an absolute majority, the role of the parliament is watered down, meaning that the parliament is usually, and especially because the two major parties that I mentioned before are quite disciplined, the party is mainly... speaking between us, and please don't quote me outside, it's more of a rubber stamp institution for what the government wants to pass. Because there's an absolute majority, there's really no discussion. Whereas if you have a minority government, things are always a bit more lively. Because even if you agree on a core of issues that you want to legislate and approve, which was the case with the current government, there's always a certain degree of unforeseen events. For instance, now we are, this Friday, the proposal for the budget will be presented to the parliament, the draft budget, and the government is currently negotiating with its partners in the parliament which measures to put in the budget so that the budget in the end will be approved. Because otherwise, the Socialist Party, who is now in power, does not have the necessary number of votes or MPs to pass the budget by itself. Coming to the core of the presentation, the political oversight that the parliament exerts, very often you might have heard of this theory of the decline of parliaments because parliaments are now competing with the government in terms of who legislates more. I don't know if it's the case in Austria or not, but our government legislates a lot. In this case, the parliament are trying, and the Portuguese Parliament has been trying, at least for the past 10 years, because we had a huge change in the rules of procedure 10 years ago, it was 2007. The Parliament since then is trying to reinvent itself, shaping the way it works, not only to be the legislative body, but also to be the one that holds the government to account. So that means that the Parliament developed a lot of tools to bring the debates to the Parliament and to force the government to share information, to be present at the Parliament at many different moments of the political life. And this is a very important issue. Also to give the opposition a certain degree of rights that do not depend on the circumstantial majority that won the elections. This is a very important point of our system. So this quote is just for you to then be able to understand a little bit more what I'm saying. The Parliament tried to compensate the way it works by accepting that it lost a certain degree of its legislative responsibility, and now is compensating this with different powers of supervision. Coming back to the current situation that we have, this new parliamentary constellation produces very different consequences. For instance, and I will come to that, if a minority parliament wants to establish a parliamentary committee of inquiry, that does not depend on the circumstantial majority. Opposition can force a parliamentary committee of inquiry, and the outcome of this situation is unforeseeable even for the government. The situation that we have now, it's quite peculiar because especially the Communist Party and the left bloc were never in such a situation as to support a government. So that means we're talking about 10 to 18% of the electorate who are now represented in the governance, to put it in a very broad way. But these two political parties, the left bloc and the Communist Party, are very attached to the parliamentary institution. So that means they conceive the system as a system where the central role is for the parliament. So all the debate has to go through parliament, all the negotiation has to go through parliament, all the debate has to go through parliament. So that means that for the Socialist Party to have such partners on board means that the government has to pay a different attention to the parliament, the government has to pay a different attention to the parliament as well. And that is one of the main features of our situation now. We have elections in 2019. I don't know which parliament will come out of that. I don't know if this will leave long-lasting marks, but we are here to witness it. Another important aspect is that this situation, as I said in the beginning, is quite new for us, because since 1976, the results of the elections that I showed you in the third slide was more or less the same. So that means that in eight of the legislatures so far, we had a left majority with the socialists and the communists and other parties to the left. But they were never able to agree on anything. They were never able to agree on something that would allow the socialists to govern in a minority with the support of other parties in the parliament. So this is all brand new, and it has to do with those issues outside the formal design of the constitution. We had the Troika for 3 years, we had a right-wing government for that period, so that means that these political parties felt it was the moment to change also their own paradigm of working in the parliament. Coming to the presence of members of government in the plenary. We have the way we work in the Portuguese Parliament. A normal week in the Portuguese Parliament is as follows. On Mondays, there are no members in the Parliament because members are in their constituencies doing their political work. Then on Tuesdays, the whole day, and on Wednesdays in the morning, it's when committees meet. And then on Thursdays afternoon, and on Friday morning, we have the plenary. So usually we have three plenaries a week. Okay? The way the debates are scheduled are according to the Conference of Leaders. In the Conference of Leaders, which is chaired by the Speaker of the Parliament, all the political parties have a seat, and also the government has a seat. So they are the ones defining for every fortnight which debates are going to take place. The presence of the government is always one of the most important aspects of those scheduling, especially because, as I will try to mention, we have different, very different ways of calling ministers to come. The Prime Minister is very often at the Parliament. Ministers are very often at the Parliament, either upon a request by one of the groups, either by exerting a potestative right. And in that slide, you can see that firstly, we have in the beginning of the legislature a debate on the government's program. It is not mandatory that this government is voted, but if a vote is called, it has to be approved. The case of this government was that the vote was called and the government's program was voted down and the government was dismissed. Then we have the possibility to submit motions of confidence or no confidence, and then simple majority works. We have debates with the Prime Minister. Every 15 days, the Prime Minister is in the Parliament. And we also have debates with the Prime Minister prior to every European Council. Then we have debates with ministers. I will highlight some of them. We have calls upon the government, which means that the Parliament can, summon the government to be at the Parliament. And then we have debates on current affairs, emergency debates, or thematic debates. Every year, by the end of the legislative session, which is more or less June, July, we have a debate on the state of the nation. And then we also have the debate of the state budget, which is about to start in the next weeks. As I mentioned earlier as well, in 2007 we had a massive reform of the rules of procedure, which somehow tried to balance things a little bit more between the plenary and the committees. Prior to that, the length of the debates was very criticized. The debates were very long, members would speak like filibusters, the focus of the issues was not the one which was really relevant for any people outside the Parliament, and the work at committee level was quite superficial. So this reform tried to balance things more, tried to transform the plenary into the main political arena for the big topics, the big political debates, and the technical work, the content-wise, more substantial work is done at committee level. So this is the structure we have now. It's been 10 years. We can already identify some patterns. Committees have grown a lot in their importance. That's also why we had to develop a whole video on demand system, mostly to cover the work of the committees. And the plenary is transforming itself also into this main political arena. To give you some examples of the debates, and this is something which for some parliaments is quite an innovation. The Prime Minister in Portugal is very often at the Parliament. Before 2007, it was up to the Prime Minister to decide whether he would show his grace to the Parliament or not. Nowadays, it is mandatory for the Prime Minister to come every fortnight to discuss with members topics chosen by both sides. We have two formats. In one of the formats, it's the Prime Minister who opens the debate, 10 minutes, and then there's a single round of questions for all the political parties. So that means that, for instance, the biggest political party, which is the one who won the election but is not in the government, has, let's say, 15 minutes, but the other political parties have 10 minutes, 12 minutes. So the difference between the majority and the opposition is not so contrasting. So that makes these debates very lively also for the opposition. The second format is directly questions from the MPs without an introductory speech by the Prime Minister. So that means it's rotating. It's not always the same political party who opens the debate. So that means that, for instance, a political party that has a parliamentary group that has two members will come, it's time to open the debate and question the Prime Minister on whatever topic they deem appropriate. Then, under the law of scrutiny of EU affairs, the Prime Minister should also attend the plenary to debate the topics which are to be discussed at each European Council. This was an innovation that goes back to 2006, when the first law, well, not the first law, but the first real law on EU affairs was approved. And it's a debate meant to engage the Parliament in EU affairs at the highest political level. Prior to that, it would be the Prime Minister inviting the political parties to go to the official residence of the Prime Minister behind closed doors to brief them on whatever is going to be discussed. Now this debate takes place at the Parliament. This, do you have a couple of figures about how many debates of this kind we've had? If you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt, okay?
Thank you.
Yep.
I think there are no questions.
Okay, I can go on then, okay. Then debates on current affairs. This is quite common. And this is one that I would specifically draw your attention to, because in this case, a parliamentary group can summon the government to come to the parliament with more or less 24 hours, 48 hours notice. So that means even if the Conference of Leaders schedules debates for the next 15 days, if a parliamentary group feels that there's a topic of the highest political importance for the nation, they can summon the minister to come to the parliament. We had recently a case like this because we had some issues with the military and with some stolen material from a military facility. And from Friday to Monday, the Minister of Defense was forced to come to the parliament. And this is something that the government cannot simply refuse to attend. They can choose who comes, but they bear a political cost if they don't send the appropriate minister. So this is something which happens a lot, and that the parliamentary groups at the beginning of each legislature, there is, of course, according to the number of members they have also a certain number of potestative rights that they can use, and they choose to use it according to their own political convenience and agenda. But in this case, as I said before, it does not depend on the majority. The majority cannot simply say, we don't accept, because it's a potestative right of the parliamentary groups. Then they can call, the parliamentary groups can call upon the government as well to discuss matters of general or sectoral policy. Or emergency debates can also be adjourned. In this case, it is not immediate. Even the emergency debate is less emergent than the one I mentioned before, but it's also based on the same logics. It's a potestative right, so it cannot be voted down by the majority. On the other hand, we also have the possibility of the committees, the parliamentary committees themselves, proposing thematic debates at the plenary, or the speaker or even the government can propose to the plenary to have a certain debate on a certain topic. This is not a tool which is often used, but it is growing in importance. This, as I mentioned before, it's the potestative rights per parliamentary group for each legislative session. So that means that each parliamentary group is entitled to a certain number of atomic bombs, so to say, to use throughout a legislative session. In some cases, they use them all. Those who are in the government usually don't exert these potestative rights, but the opposition, as you can see, has a lot of tools at their disposal to force the government to come and to address any issues they deem appropriate within the remit of each minister. The parliamentary committees. We now have let's to put it simply, two kinds of hearings of ministers at committee level. Ministers are each week, two or three or four ministers come to the parliamentary committees every week, because we have also an article in our rules of procedure that states that each minister must be heard. The competent committee of its sphere of competences at least four times in each legislative session. This is mandatory and only the dates are negotiable. So that means that the committees can schedule their work, they can schedule their work of oversight according to the dates which are fixed more or less at this stage, September, October, until June, July. So that means that each minister has to pencil in these dates and know that at least four times in each legislative session he or she must come to the parliament. In some cases, we have committees which have a huge span of competences, like the Constitutional Affairs Committee, so that means that they have four ministers under their remit. So that means that it's at least four times four for these hearings, which include also the hearing which is mandatory for the state budget. On the other hand, members of the committees or the parliamentary groups representing the committees can also exert potestative rights to hear ministers at committee level. There's also a distribution as for the plenary. So that means that each time a parliamentary group in a certain committee feels that the four times that the minister comes to the committee, or if it is still too far away the hearing, they can exert this potestative right to summon the minister to come to the committee. The minister can drag his feet a little bit on the date. It's not mandatory on the immediate summoning of the minister, but he or she has to come to the committee to discuss the topics that the parliamentary group who raised the issue wants to address. Then a third possibility is not the mandatory ones according to rules of procedure, or not the mandatory ones according to the potestative rights, but a simple request filed by a parliamentary group to have one of the members coming to the committee. This is something that, if we have a government with an absolute majority in the parliament, it's something that is often used but often refused. Because if there is, for instance, an issue with the health system, an issue with defense, an issue with the state budget, if the government has an absolute majority in the parliament, they will vote down this simple request that has to be approved at committee level. However, in the current situation that we are living now, as I said in the beginning, the two of the parliamentary groups who support the government are keen on strengthening the role of the parliament. So that means that they have as a principle in their political action in the parliament to accept any request, even if they come from the other side. So that means that this tool in this current legislature is being often used, which made the number of hearings, and I will come to that a little bit later on, number of hearings of members of government at committee level skyrocketed completely. As I said before, under the ones which are potestative, the parliamentary group can force the ministers to come but not impose a date. And there was an issue in recent times whether this article would cover also the Prime Minister. The case was dealt with at the Constitutional Affairs, and the issue at stake was, because the Secret Service depends, the system of information depends directly on the Prime Minister, one of the political parties wanted to have the Prime Minister at committee level to discuss issues pertaining to the way the Secret Services were being handled. At the time, there was no doctrine or jurisprudence about this, And the Speaker of the Parliament then interpreted herself that the Prime Minister is some sort of primus inter pares in the government, which is under the scrutiny of the plenary, but not under the scrutiny of the committees. So the interpretation was that this article does not include the Prime Minister, but of course the political party who wanted to politically capitalize on the issue did it anyway. But for the future, we now know that according to that interpretation, this article does not include the Prime Minister, but this issue keeps on resurfacing every now and then. As I mentioned before, and I will try to give you some concrete examples. In the previous legislature, we had an absolute majority government, and we had a very very unpopular Minister of Finance, very unpopular Minister of Health, because many cuts were made, etc. So the opposition was always trying to call them to come to the Parliament. Either they would use their protestative rights, or they would try to file a simple request. All the simple requests which were filed, the majority of cases, were voted down. So that meant that the rights of the opposition were still there, but the absolute majority was somehow refraining the Parliament of exploiting its full potential. As you can see, at committee level, this is the number of protestative rights that we have. If you have more than 46 members, you are entitled to have 5 protestative rights, up until the parliamentary group, which has only 2, which are the Greens, that are entitled to 1. Still, this is often used, but in the current legislature, we are witnessing a bit of a change, because the protestative rights exercised so far in 2 years or so of this current legislature were only 3. Because the parliamentary groups, even those in the opposition, are now used to file simple requests, and since the political parties, namely the ones who support the government, have this perception of the parliament as the arena where all the debates should take place, they accept every request. For instance, this is what we had as the protestative rights in the previous legislature. 6 in the first session, 5 in the second session, around 20 in the overall legislature of 4 years. In this case, we only have 3 so far, so we are far, far from that. I chose one of the cases of a committee which is usually in the spotlight, which is the Committee on Health. The Committee on Health in the previous legislature had very, very few hearings with ministers, and the few that they had were the ones which are mandatory according to the rules of procedure and the ones which came after a protestative right. In this case, as I mentioned before, in the previous legislature they had 17 requests of the opposition for members of government to be present at the committee. All of them were voted down by the absolute majority of the 2 parties who were in the government. In this case, in this current legislature, out of the 13 hearings held so far, 6 of them were upon simple requests, and all the simple, and this is data of May 2017, because I didn't have sufficient time to gather the data from now. But in May 2017, and I'm sure there are more now, all the 6 simple requests that the committee had were accepted. So this means that there is a significant change in the work of the committees. And there is a significant change also for the government, because they never know which topic will be so high on the agenda that the parliament all of a sudden wakes up on a Monday and summons the ministers to come here on a Tuesday or a Wednesday. That changes our work a lot, because you can plan as committee staff a very stable and foreseeable week, And then over the weekend, there's an outbreak of a disease, for instance, as it was the case some months ago. And all of a sudden, the parliamentary groups start filing motions or requests to hear the minister that week, to hear the director general that week. So all the agenda you had on Friday vanishes, and you have a whole new agenda because of this system that we have that not only gives the opposition a lot of rights, but also develop this tendency to have members of government at committee level, and also the situation that we have now that the political parties favor the role of the parliament. This means more work for us, but also a greater visibility for the parliament. And to come to the end, I chose also another example that I mentioned before, parliamentary committees of inquiry. Parliamentary committees of inquiry are a very specific tool also of oversight, also to supervise the way the administration and the government work. They can be established through a plenary resolution, which is the simplest way. So that means that someone, a parliamentary group, proposes a resolution to form a parliamentary committee of inquiry. In our case, the most recent cases and the most popular ones were, with no surprise, about banks. We had 6 or 7 parliamentary committees of inquiry about banks. We had, in this current legislature, which has 2 years now, already 3 committees of inquiry about banks, 2 about the same bank. And one of my colleagues who gives support to 2 of those committees is here, so if you have any question on parliamentary committees of inquiry, I will give the floor to her. But let's imagine that the current government would not like to have a parliamentary committee of inquiry about the bank, which was the case for the last 2 committees of inquiry, because it was about the public bank, which was being recapitalized. There was a negotiation with Brussels taking place. So the government felt that it was counterproductive to have a parliamentary committee of inquiry about a bank which was operating, which was in the market with no resolution, etc. However, we have a feature in our rules of procedure and in our legal regime of the parliamentary committees of inquiry that allows the minorities to impose a potestative parliamentary committee of inquiry. The figures are there. A motion has to be made by 1/5 of the members, so that means 46 members. So that means that the opposition, usually nowadays the opposition has 89 members of the party who won the elections, they can impose committees of inquiry the way they deem appropriate. The rules on parliamentary committees of inquiry give them the power of almost, we say, quasi-investigative powers. They can require all documentation concerning a certain issue. They can even ask, as it was asked for this last one, that the bank secret is overthrown. Unfortunately, I cannot share with you the outcome of that procedure because the Parliament, for the first time, decided to go to court against a certain number of institutions, namely the public bank, to have the bank secrecy undisclosed. But the committee of inquiry was ended before the court could pronounce, so we will never know what would have happened. But the tendency was that the court would consider that the public interest of the parliamentary committee of inquiry was superior to the right of the bank to keep its bank secrecy. Then these committees have allowed for what we usually call ex post scrutiny and oversight of the way the government or any other institution works. In some cases, it was the work of the parliamentary committees of inquiry which allowed for even the Attorney General to draw some conclusions. It happens very often, especially at the committees, that we receive requests from the courts, from the investigation, to have access to documents that the parliamentary committees of inquiry have in their possession and that were never given to the investigative authorities. So this allows also for the opposition to bring certain issues which are not so comfortable for the government under public scrutiny at the parliament. Concluding remarks. The first point that I would like to highlight is that the Portuguese Parliament is extremely generous towards minority rights. There are lots of privileges for the opposition, not only in terms of speaking times, of scheduling debates, of summoning members of government to be at the plenary and at committee level, which also helps the Parliament to be at the center stage of the political system in Portugal. On the other hand, the Parliament is somehow flooded with oversight instruments. There are so many instruments, as I mentioned, the thematic debates, urgent debates, Prime Minister, the kinds of hearing that you have at committee level, that it's almost impossible to use all of them effectively. It's been 10 years now. There are no signs on whether the political parties are willing to revise the rules of procedure again, but eventually when they do, all these issues have to be factored in and evaluated. But from my personal perspective, the way that the opposition is enshrined in the system will not go back, because it is useful for the parties who are in the opposition, and those who are now, especially the biggest parties, who are now in government, know that eventually in some years they will be in the opposition, so they want to keep this balance between the two sides. On the other hand, we are victims somehow of the success of the Parliament in terms of mediatic agenda, which means that the media, and especially nowadays, social media, Facebook, YouTube, etc., put a tremendous pressure on the Parliament's agenda. Before being in the committees, I was head of unit for the parliamentary TV channel when this new system was developed. And if there's one thing that members care about, is their own video to put on their Facebook page. Regardless of what they say, immediately when a committee meeting is over, we are getting phone calls, emails, asking for the slice. They don't care about what else was discussed, but the slice of video that refers to them. So if all members have Facebook pages, they have YouTube channels, and this means that they also put themselves in the spotlight, and it comes back to the Parliament as a boomerang effect, because sometimes the Parliament has to go after the mediatic agenda, and not necessarily after what is really important at a certain moment. But this is the time that we live. In our case as staff, we have to learn very often, as I write there, that we have the rules of procedure, we have the Constitution, but then we have politics. And in many cases, at the end of the day, as I usually tell my colleagues, it's always politics over procedure. So if there's a political party, public pressure on a certain issue, that will override any procedure and will come on top of the parliamentary agenda. And this is something that we have to live in. The current system that we have, with no absolute majority, from my personal perspective, increases the role of the parliament as the center of the political debate, and also increases its leverage as the main arena to raise the public awareness. I wouldn't go as far as to say that we are now living an era of a semi-parliamentary system, but what we can watch now and observe is that the Parliament, at least since 2015, with this current constellation, became a very relevant actor in our system, and that is something that, for us civil servants of the Parliament, brings an added layer of interest to our daily work. And that's it. So if you have questions, please feel free.
Thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. I would like to ask my colleagues now if there are any questions. Yes, please.
I would like to come back what you mentioned about the committees and the broadcasting of the 8 committees at the same time. Are you providing any inserts for the while you're broadcasting, so that the public knows who is taking the floor, to which political party the person belongs, or are you just showing the picture of the committees?
Just give me 1 second, okay? Sorry, I'm not listening. I heard the question, but I didn't hear the follow-up. Now it's okay. Can you please repeat?
My first question was about the inserts you provide during the broadcasting of the committees. Is there any information who is taking the floor, to which political party this person belongs? And the second question is about, are you providing video on demand of these committee meetings also? Or are you only giving the slices to the MPs who want to have them, that they can use them in their Facebook profile?
So, can you hear me? Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so the broadcasting, we have inserts. We have inserts with the name of the member of parliament who is speaking, or the member of the government who's speaking, or even the entity, if, for instance, we have a director general, or if we have a trade union here, there's always a subtitle with the name and the institution. For members, with the name and the political party. Okay? So this means that we have to have our staff, it's not automatic, so we have to have our staff of the parliamentary TV channel in real time feeding that information into the system. Okay? Secondly, we don't just give the slices. We broadcast the entire committee meeting, okay? For instance, if we have a parliamentary committee meeting that lasts for 6 hours, 7 hours, which happens, we broadcast the entire thing, okay, from the beginning until the end, and then it is immediately uploaded to the website, because the infrastructure of the system allows for the video to be immediately posted online. So I can send you the link. It's in Portuguese, but you can more or less understand the framework. It is divided according to plenary sessions, committee meetings, and other events. For instance, if we have Ban Ki-moon in the parliament, like we had last year, there's a reception by the Speaker of the Parliament that is also covered, so that goes to other events. As for the committee meetings, it is divided into different folders: Constitutional Affairs Committee, Foreign Affairs Committee, Defense Committee. So you just enter that folder and you can see all the videos that we have since December 2015 onwards. That's available there. We are now working on an archive, a digital archive, to make available all the videos from the past, since 2003, since we have the broadcasting of the committee meetings. So each week, if you have, for instance, 20, 25, between Tuesday morning and Wednesday lunchtime, as I mentioned, when the committees meet, if you have 20, 25 meetings, and if all the committees ask for the broadcasting of their video, they will be broadcast. Okay, we are now even working on a major logistic change within the parliament to equip more committee meeting rooms like this one with cameras and with the video system, so that we can cover even more. Because that's trying to be ahead of our time, and that's what the public outside and members inside require from us.
And how many people are working in this broadcasting unit?
Yeah, that's the million-euro question. So we have, when I was there, we have one coordinator who is some sort of the boss of the parliamentary TV channel, and we have four people. four people to operate the cameras, and we have two journalists. So that means that each meeting needs at least two people to change. So that means that according to the system that we have now, we have to hire externally people to help us broadcast all the meetings, which is a lot more expensive than if we would do it in-house. Hopefully, in the coming weeks, we will open a public competition to hire people specifically for the Parliamentary TV channel, because in the long run, it will be cheaper to have people from the Parliament, staff of the Parliament, trained by the Parliament, working for the Parliament exclusively to do this, instead of hiring people outside, which costs three or four times more than a year's salary of someone who is permanently here. But as it stands now, we have four people doing this, which is quite short.
And do you also measure the public interest in these videos?
If we measure, that was the question.
Yes.
Yes. We do measure.
So because it costs a lot of money to make this, and how many is this really used by the public?
Yeah, we do measure. We do measure in two different ways. One is statistical and the other one is empirical. The statistical one is that we have, I'm talking about the website. So the Portuguese Parliament has three ways of broadcasting its works. Cable TV, the digital TV, which is the one that covers the entire territory of Portugal, and online. So this means that the system that I refer to is the online system where you can go and choose the one that you want to watch. The system that we have is made to produce statistics. So we know every month or every day if we want to how many hits we had on the website. I'm no longer working there, so forgive me if I don't know the numbers by heart, but I can provide you the numbers afterwards. So we have statistics on a daily, on a weekly, and on a monthly basis about how many accesses we had to the website, how long did people stay in a certain committee meeting broadcast or in the plenary. And we know, for instance, when I was there, the top of the ranking was the state budget, which is something that always draws a lot of attention. On the other hand, the empirical one is that prior to this system, we could only broadcast one. So we would have people complaining, yeah, but you have a committee of inquiry and the guy who's there is more interesting than this boring minister that you have in the other committee meeting room. But we have, the Parliamentary TV channel has a board, and the board is composed of members of parliament, one per parliamentary group. And they are the ones who define what is broadcast as a priority, and this was especially in the scenario that you could only broadcast one thing. So members of government always have a priority, even if in the next room you are hearing on a parliamentary committee of inquiry someone who deviated 3 billion euros, for instance, hypothetically. Nowadays, they can choose, but in those days, we would have people complaining that you could only broadcast one. Now people complain that we broadcast too much and that we should split the works in a way that they could watch everything. On the other hand, if one day, which happens, I mean, these are systems which can fail, and sometimes last week we had 5 minutes with no audio. In one day we had a committee meeting which was labeled with the wrong title of the committee. Whenever that happens, we are flooded with phone calls, emails, Facebook messages of people complaining, yeah, you don't know what you're doing, the parliament never knows what they're doing. So people are there and they are watching. The only feedback that we get is when things go wrong.
Okay.
But that, for us, it's okay. It's part of it. It comes with the package. If people complain, it's because they're watching. And if people complain, and sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong, sometimes they don't know how the system works, so they don't know where to find the video that they want, we are also here to help. And sometimes the failures are on our side as well. Then we apologize, we learn. And this is a system that has less than 2 years. So we are still learning how to develop it.
And one last question I have. Are you also sharing these videos on Facebook and giving the people the possibility to make comments?
Yes, and we don't moderate the comments. So we have a Facebook page of the Parliamentary TV channel. And on that Facebook page, the Parliament is struggling nowadays on how to position itself generally in social media. There's no official account of the Parliament on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, on Tinder, anywhere. There's no official page, but there are pages. The Parliamentary TV channel has one page, the Cultural Department of the Parliament has one page, and in the page of the Parliamentary TV channel, we are trying to put some more dynamics. For instance, every time there's a broadcast, we advertise the broadcast with the link for the page where you can watch. Then people comment, but surprisingly or not, the comments we receive are not negative. I would say that I've been there a year and a half, and out of, I don't know, 500, 600 comments, I received two which were negative. And they were not negative about the work of the Parliamentary TV channel, they were negative about politicians. then on...
Do the parliamentarians also use this to get in contact with the people to start a discussion? If the people, as you told us, are complaining about politics, are they then interacting with the people, the parliamentarians?
Yes, but not via our official channel. I'll explain. In the website of the Parliamentary TV channel, you can create your profile either with your email and username or with your Facebook account. So if you log in with your Facebook account, it immediately connects. So you can choose your favorites. If you just want to watch Committee on Culture, you just watch Committee on Culture. You go there to your favorites and it's all there. Okay? If you really liked a video of the cultural committee, you can share immediately that video on your Facebook page. It's automatic. You just click on that symbol to share and it's shared. On the other hand, members of Parliament use, as I said, the videos that the Parliament TV channel produces for their own purpose. Two examples. There is one member from the Socialist Party who at the end of each legislative session, he records a video with the assistance of the Parliamentary TV channel, a very short video, 2-3 minutes, where he says to his electorate, this is what I've done last year. So then he uses that video, he puts that in his YouTube channel, he shares that on his social media and calls for comments. This is one thing. On the other hand, there was a group of members from one electoral district in the north of Portugal, which is called Vila Real, who did the same, but for all the members of that political party elected in that circle. So what they did is that they gathered all the videos of the interventions of their members, of the members of that electoral district, during a legislative session. They gathered it in a YouTube video that you could choose, and they send it to a lot of people. I was one of them, that's why I know. They send it to a lot of people saying, this was our work during the last legislative session. And then they engage with people on their Facebook, on their YouTube accounts. It's mostly Facebook because it's still, which is more often used. But in the Parliamentary TV channel, we just provide, in the Facebook page, we just provide institutional information. So the debate about the state budget is taking place. Please follow it here. Then you click on the link and it directs you to the Parliamentary TV channel website, and then people can watch. And then members can do whatever they want. They have their, when we created the system, we also created a parallel system that each parliamentary group has in their facilities here inside the Parliament. Also a server and a machine, a computer, to immediately copy and cut the videos that they want for their own purpose. So they don't rely on the four people we have at the Parliamentary TV channel to cut their videos. Their own staff does it with the equipment that the Parliament provides. Okay?
Excuse me, this would be the next question. So there is no production of the videos for the video on demand system, meaning we offer the videos of sittings as a whole and not the cut version, so no snippets of it.
Can you repeat the question, because the audio was not good at the beginning?
Yes, of course, I'm sorry. My question would be, there is no post-production, so normally you just put on the whole videos of sittings and no cut versions of it. Is that right?
There's no post-production for the parliamentary proceedings, so which means that for the committees and for the plenary, there's no post-production activity at all. There are certain rules of conduct. For instance, if a minister is at the committee, and the minister sits normally there on my left-hand side, and the members sit here where I am, this is a normal committee meeting room. If the member of parliament is questioning the minister, and if it's a very lively discussion, what the people who are operating the video do is that they shift the camera between one and another. Okay, so if a member is really angry, saying "Yeah, you should be fired," then they switch the camera to the minister to see his expression, and then they go back to the member of parliament, trying to make the debates a little bit more lively and not so monotonous. On the other hand, in the plenary, there are also some rules of conduct. For instance, if there are demonstrations in the galleries, we don't film concrete people on their faces. We just show a plan, which then goes away. For instance, some months ago, there was a member of parliament who fainted in the plenary. She was not feeling well, and she fainted. She fell on the floor. Any other television, which is also inside the plenary, were filming the lady on the floor. We don't do that. We preserve the image of the parliament and of members, so we don't film that, we film something else. We film the speaker, we film the other side of the parliament. Those certain rules of conduct are always present. There is post-production on certain content that we developed in recent years. For instance, if Ban Ki-moon comes, to use the same example, if Ban Ki-moon comes, there's a team of the parliamentary TV channel who follows the one day and a half that Ban Ki-moon is in the parliament, meeting with the speaker, meeting with the committee, the guard of honor outside, and then they put it into a clip. Okay? For instance, for the state budget, we are also trying to do some sort of didactic school materials for people outside the parliament to understand how the parliament works. Last year, or in 2015, if I'm not mistaken, we shot a video of the state budget. How is the state budget approved? So for a month, we filmed the moment the government comes to the parliament to introduce the bill. Then we filmed the hearings at committee level. Then we filmed the work in the committee. Then we filmed the voting, then we filmed the final approval, and we post-edited a video explaining how the budget works. More recently, we've done a video of the work of the second legislative session of the parliament. So we gathered all the big moments of the previous legislative session, the most lively plenary sessions, the approval of the budget, the committees of inquiry, into one video. I can then send you some examples. It's in Portuguese, but you can more or less see how it is constructed. Okay. And this, of course, members are also trying to get used to it, because in the past, members didn't like so much this post-production activity, because they feel that the role of the Parliament TV channel is to film the proceedings without any other editing. However, nowadays people ask for some more contents besides the plenary and the committees. There was a huge discussion because members felt that if his neighbor from the other party had 1 second more than he did in the video could not go on air. But I think we have passed through that storm. Members are now used to having this sort of contents. They like it, they share it, and that's the way to move forward. In our case, of course.
Okay, great, thank you.
I have one follow-up question. How many cameras do you use to broadcast one committee sitting? How many do you have in the room?
As you meant. How many cameras?
How many?
Okay, so in this room where we are, we have three cameras. So there's one at the end. Maybe we can show, no? Ricardo, podemos mostrar. I'll show you, okay? So we have one in front, which films there, you see at the end?
Okay.
Yeah? It's that little black thing. And then we have one on each side. One behind me, which would film people on the other side. And then we have one behind my colleague there, which would film me if I was now on television.
Okay. And broadcast, are the sittings of the committees public? So can the people come to visit the committees?
Yes, as a principle, yes. all committees are public, except if the committee decides otherwise at the beginning of each meeting. For instance, the Committee on Defense, the two who most often use the prerogative to meet behind closed doors are the Committee on Defense and the Committee on Foreign Affairs. The Committee on Defense, usually when they have a high-ranking military here or a Minister of Defense about very sensitive issues, or the Committee on Foreign Affairs when they have an ambassador talking about Brexit, for instance. On the other hand, parliamentary committees of inquiry also have the same rule. It is generally public unless it is decided otherwise, and in the case of the parliamentary committees of inquiry, there's a specific article in the legal regime of the committees of inquiry that entitles the person who is summoned to come to the Parliamentary Committee of Inquiry to ask for the meeting to be behind closed doors for matters pertaining to the protection of privacy, etc., etc., etc. But, of course, members like public meetings because public meetings help build political careers, so that's also part of the game. The Parliamentary Committees of Inquiry in recent years in Portugal have helped build lots of political careers, very successful ones, and of course members who take part in the next Parliamentary Committee of Inquiry, whatever the topic is, they want the meetings to be public.
Of course. And do you have a special for the public, or how many people fit in your rooms? Is it used?
It depends. It depends. I mean, we don't have crowds coming to the parliament to watch the meetings here, also because they can watch them online. But in a meeting like this, in a meeting room like this, I would say we have around 30 seats around the main table, out of which 7-8 are for the press. So the press is also entitled to attend any committee meeting room, any committee meeting they deem appropriate. Yeah, I would say this is one of the bigger rooms, but in general 10-20 seats for the public. But it is very, very rare that we have such a huge number of people attending the meetings. In the plenary, yes, we have groups coming to watch the plenary proceedings, but at committee level it's not that common. If there is, for instance, a trade union about a very specific topic about labor law, etc., sometimes they bring cheerleaders. That happens. It happened some time ago that they brought around. It was not a trade union. It was a city hall that had an issue about belonging to one zone or the other, and they brought around 90 people. Which doesn't fit in any room, 90 people. So what we did is that we put them in a different auditorium and we used the channel, we used the feed of the Parliamentary TV channel to have them watching the broadcast in real time.
Okay. So you have to deal with issues like political actionism or something like that, like security matters?
I couldn't hear the word exactly. I think you're a bit far from the microphone, that's why.
Yeah, sorry. Do you have to deal with issues like political actionism or something like that if there is something on the agenda which is controversial? Like today we have a committee which deals with TTIP, the a trade agreement, and there are some NGOs, and it's 12 people listening from the public. It's not so much, but there is always the concern that there could be some actions or something like that. Do we have to deal with such topics?
During the period from 2011 to 2014, during the Troika period, we had many issues like that at the plenary. there were lots of demonstrations at the plenary. Even though people, to enter the parliament, they have to go through a screening process. The palace of the parliament is guarded by the police. They have to be registered when they enter, but you never know if they will demonstrate once they are sitting inside the room. We had cases like that. We even had a case of a lady who was charged and convicted in courts by offences to the Prime Minister in the plenary, using footage also of the parliamentary TV channel, but that's part of life, it's public footage. But at committee level, not really. At committee level, there's not, as far as I can remember, we had one case recently of a citizen who is very diligent in terms of education. There's a citizen who is very keen on cultural, educational, language issues. He's a professor. He knows a lot about the issues that parliamentarians discuss. He feels that he knows more about those issues than parliamentarians. So he wants to be present every time. One of the last times he was here, he was quite unpleasant in the way he was approaching members in the corridors, because he wanted to watch he wanted to be inside the meeting room of the committee, but he was really being rude. So we have a head of the security. He was called. The head of the public relations was called as well. I was informed, and the way the committee dealt with it was that they decided to. It was a working group to have the working group behind closed doors to avoid any turmoil, because he was really being unpleasant. But this is very, very, very rare. We had one case in 2009 of one person, a former journalist. We had a committee that was dealing with the pressure that the government was putting on televisions and the media. So this journalist was allegedly himself the target of some of those pressures. So he came to be heard at the committee, and he brought a lot of merchandise for his own propaganda. He brought a t-shirt with the name of the Prime Minister. He distributed leaflets to members, but it was quite an unusual situation because he was the one being heard, for Mário Crespo. He was the one being heard. And for the members, it was quite a situation where they didn't know how to deal with it, because he was invited to come to the parliament, but he clearly was beyond what was asked of him. But at committee level, we usually don't have that sort of situations.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions?
Yeah. Getting back to video on demand and the digital channel, distribution through the internet. Do you use any content providers? So is everything distributed directly from your site, or is there any duplication caching somewhere else?
Person, but I will try to reply the best that I can, because I participated somehow in the design. So. There was a first idea to use the broadband of someone else. But in the end, we decided to keep it all in-house. So we have, of course, when we launched this project, we had to advertise a public tender, and there was a private entity who won and who developed it, okay, which is under a contract with us. So they were the ones developing the software. They were the ones indicating which hardware to buy. And they are the ones who operate the behind-the-scenes infrastructure on a daily basis. But the servers are ours. They are here on the third floor. The broadband is hired to the normal provider. Of course, we had to hire a larger broadband because we didn't know how many accesses we would have. The one we had before was not enough, so we had to buy a larger one, which is more than sufficient. because the way the streaming works, it doesn't overload too much what we need to have as broadband. So it is pretty much done in-house, except for the software development, etc., which is done by our IT department, the TV channel staff, and this private firm who was the one that developed the system and is under a 3-year contract with us, renewable every 3 years.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. There are no more questions from our side. So, do you have any questions?
Well, I would like to know how does it work, because I mean I was not expecting so many questions on the TV channel, but when we had a seminar for ECPRD, it was pretty much the same, because it's a question that all parliaments are paying attention to. How does it work in your parliament? Do you also have a parliament TV channel in house? Do you broadcast everything?
So, for the moment, we are only broadcasting the plenary sessions. The committee meetings, most of the committee meetings are not open to the public. And we have no equipment for broadcasting the committee meetings. So we are trying now to brush up a little bit our broadcasting of the plenary sittings. We just started this inserts, but our cameras are all automatic cameras. They are focused on the microphones. So if someone takes the floor, then automatically the camera focuses on him. So that's maybe a little bit more boring than a broadcasting where you have cameramans, but it's the best way to do it now. And we are planning now to establish a video on demand service. And we are also, maybe that's interesting for you, we are also broadcasting now the translation into sign language, because we have a translation into sign language, and now we have an extra camera for this, and we have an extra channel. And then we have an in-house TV channel, which it has the same source than the online broadcasting, so it's the same picture, but it's only for the people in the parliament. And we don't have any TV channel so far, but it's the public broadcasting, the ORF, who is broadcasting almost all the parliamentary sittings.
We also have sign language. I forgot to mention that. In the broadcast, which go to cable and to the digital TV, we also have always sign language. Both plenary and the committee meeting, which is live on cable, we also have sign language. We've had that since, if I'm not mistaken, 2006. Because there's a huge demand for that. It's something we cannot shy away from.
In Austria too, there is quite important lobby for it, I would say. But the problem is we don't have enough translators for sign language. So it's not easy to cover all the sittings. We don't even think of covering all the committee meetings in sign language. That's not possible.
Yeah, we
don't have problems with the translators. You have enough translators for sign language?
When we first started in 2006, no, we didn't have many. Now, yes, also because the lobby that you mentioned also exists here, and the lobby has developed a lot of training, so I would say that the number of available translators nowadays is sufficient for us to have. We don't put sign language into all committee meetings, only the ones which are broadcast on cable. So it's one committee meeting or two per day. But that means that every day we have sign language in at least the committee which goes in the morning, in the afternoon, in the plenaries always. And we have three translators who work with us under a specific contract on a regular basis. And if we need more, what we usually do is that we reach out to the lobby that you mentioned and ask for them to indicate someone that we could use who is professional enough to work with the parliament. But we have plenty nowadays. Maybe Portuguese is easier than German.
Yeah, so thank you very much again. And yeah, I wish everyone a good day. And yeah, maybe we can meet at another ECPRD seminar or somewhere else.
We can't hear you.
Sorry, we don't hear you.
I will send you the PowerPoint presentation. And I will also send the link for the Parliament TV channel if you want to find out a little bit more. I will send it to Christoph maybe, and then he will spread it around. Okay, that's fine.
Yes, please. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
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 Leider war jetzt der Kopf nicht mehr da. Wir haben ja auch genug zu werden wollen.